there's something about Lynch's work that helps me make sense of my own mind.
There's all that sort of stuff going on, suppressing emotion versus bursts of emotion.
There's some of these tropes that you continue to see in teen television. In the 50s is when we had the invention of the teenager.
It has so much cultural power that I think it's worth asking, how does this puzzle really challenge viewers?
Hello, my name is Damon, and welcome to the first episode of Back to the Double R. Back to the Double R is a podcast about Twin Peaks. Generally speaking, we're going to be focusing on one episode of the show in each episode of our podcast. The rest of the crew will introduce themselves in just a moment, but I want to give you just kind of a quick sense of where we're coming from on this podcast. There are four of us, and each of us have sort of different levels of experience with the show. For me, this will be my, I think, 10th rewatch of the show, but others have not seen the third season yet. So we'll be coming at this from different perspectives. A quick word on spoilers before we dive in. As far as the plot of the show goes, our podcast should be pretty spoiler-free. We're not going to do any big reveals before they happen in the episodes that we're talking about. But I will add two caveats to that. One is that we're going to assume that you have seen the episode that we're talking about. So we won't spoil anything from future episodes. But today we'll be discussing the pilot. If you haven't seen the pilot, we will be discussing specific plot points there. The other thing is, this is going to be sort of a soft spoiler-free podcast insofar as we may say something like, look for other instances of this theme in the third season, or we may talk about the fact that a character will show up in the third season. So we won't get into any specifics, but there will be some sort of soft gestures to the future. So if you're not comfortable with that, this is probably not the podcast for you. So as I said, my name is Damon. I'm a Pacific Northwest native, currently transplanted to Pittsburgh, where I work as a union organizer and play in punk rock bands. I rewatched Twin Peaks every year, although I skipped last year. I've seen the original season at least 8 times. This will be my 4th watch of the third season, and I've actually seen Fire Walk With Me probably a dozen times. So I'm probably the most steeped in the world of Twin Peaks. My first exposure to Twin Peaks was actually with Fire Walk With Me. I had seen a lot of David Lynch's other films before, and one of my roommates had Fire Walk With Me on a VHS tape. Which I made the mistake of watching by myself late at night, never having seen the show before. So I finished up that feeling very unnerved and confused and more than a little bit intrigued, but it was a weird thing to watch right before bed.
And I'm Jennifer. I am a podcaster and college radio DJ and a pop culturally obsessed person. I actually have a master's degree in popular culture studies. And I first saw Twin Peaks when it first came on the air. So I remember sitting in my apartment in the dark, watching the pilot and just being blown away in 1990. I, at the time, recorded Twin Peaks on VHS and must have rewatched it at least once on my own videotapes. I remember a friend of mine was visiting from New Zealand and we binge watched a bunch of Twin Peaks that I had videotaped soon after the first season had come out. And then she left and could not access the remaining episodes. So she was very bummed about that. But it's been a long time since I've watched those early seasons and I have not seen the Showtime series. So I'm excited about this project to rewatch Twin Peaks and see how it unfolds.
My name is Jonathan. Damon and I went to high school together. That's probably important for everyone to know. That's how we met. I am also a native Pacific Northwesterner. Moved to Washington in April of 1988. So I'm 40 years old, do the math. And in terms of how many times I've gone through the show, I did originally watch the series when it aired, although not from the pilot. I was the weird 10-year-old kid who, you know, stayed up way too late and, you know, snuck on his own TV to watch this strange show about murder and coffee. And so my parents were like, we don't quite understand what's going on with our oldest son here, but it is what it is. So I did watch it when it first aired, and I've since probably seen at least through the first two seasons and the movie probably 2, 3, 4 times somewhere around there. And I've only seen the season 3 one time, but I have seen all of it, and I'm not too familiar with some of the supplementary materials that are also part of the canon of the show, like The Secret Diary of Laura Palmer or some of Mark Frost's reflections on Twin Peaks. Damon is probably a lot more, versed in the knowledge of that sort of stuff. But yeah, you know, I'm looking forward to talking about Twin Peaks with everybody. Glad to get into it.
Hey, I'm Colin. I have known Damon for about 10 years. We went to grad school together. I've known Jennifer for roughly 1 million years. We worked together in San Francisco years and years ago. I studied communication, and a lot of that was studying media and film and TV and how we think about stories and how those stories become our reality. So I'm really interested to dig into this. I have not watched Twin Peaks since the original airing. So it is, I'm sort of at the opposite end of the spectrum from Damon. I feel like I know it really well, and a lot of it has stuck in my mind, but I don't have that rewatch pattern that these guys have. So I'm going to be a little bit of a fresh mind. Exploring how things hit my memory and what comes up as we go episode by episode. I watched the first season of Twin Peaks over 2 days at the end of college with a friend who had a bootleg copy. And it was a really weird way to wrap up college and head out to my first job in San Francisco. Like I say, it's stuck with me ever since then.
So this episode will be about the pilot episode of Twin Peaks. And we'll start off by just sort of contextualizing things a little bit. The pilot episode of Twin Peaks, which I would consider to be, even in this golden age of television, as some people have called it, perhaps the 90 greatest minutes of American television, begins with the discovery of the body of a young girl named Laura Palmer on a beach. For the next half an hour or so, we watch the people of the town react to the news of her death, after which Special Agent Dale Cooper arrives in town to investigate the murder of Laura Palmer. So there's a lot of exposition in this episode, and it really sets the scene for everything that will come next.
And a couple of really good technical details to know about the pilot episode of Twin Peaks. It originally aired on April 8th of 1990, so we're coming up on 31 years. It was broadcast on ABC Network, which, well, I don't know if it was owned by Disney at the time, but it is certainly owned by Disney now. So in many ways, a weirder show could not have come on like a more normal all-American broadcast network, which I think is extremely ironic. A couple of good things to note. It is directed by David Lynch, who is the director of such films as Eraserhead and Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, all of which kind of inform and speak to Twin Peaks in different ways. The the episode was written by Lynch and Mark Frost, who is also the co-runner of the show. So Lynch and Frost shepherded the show, at least certainly through the first season and many of the episodes, and both returned many years later to co-run season three. It has a runtime of 94 minutes, which was like on a network broadcast, a 2-hour special. It was shown on a Sunday night as a Sunday night movie. It's also important to know, if you are dipping into the Twin Peaks fandom, that they recorded a alternate ending to it, which is known as the European version, that's non-canonical, although footage from the non-canonical episode will show up in different episodes of Twin Peaks. The other thing I'd like to touch on is that in terms of the ratings, it was viewed by 34.6 million people with the 21.7 rating. And to put that in context, the average highest broadcast show of 2020 was NCIS, which has average viewers of 15.4 million. And in my opinion, is nowhere near the quality of show as Twin Peaks. So no offense to the NCIS fans, but make of that what you will.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about what I'm interested in exploring on our podcast. I am a huge consumer of teen popular culture, and in particular, teen movies and teen TV shows. And I think Twin Peaks, looking back at Twin Peaks, is a really interesting way to understand the whole universe of teen media. And we can certainly see connections between Twin Peaks and shows that have followed it. So shows like Riverdale and Pretty Little Liars definitely have nods to Twin Peaks. But it's also interesting to look back, I think, at some of the predecessor shows and, you know, like Dark Shadows and as another sort of gothic soap, but also think about other teen media like West Side Story. We'll find that there's a character in Twin Peaks who was also in West Side Story, and there's this kind of thread where some of these in the production, so some of the actors that we see in Twin Peaks may have been in other teen shows before Twin Peaks. And then in contemporary shows in 2020, we might see some actors that were in Twin Peaks. So I love that kind of the connections that you might see between different teen TV shows and movies over the years. And then the genre bending nature, Twin Peaks was billed as a soap opera, which we sort of forget about kind of in the ensuing years. I think a lot of us focus on the weirdness of it, but it really is a soap opera. And the first episode, which we'll get more into, it becomes apparent that it's a soap opera. And it wasn't the first nighttime soap, and it wasn't the first sort of dark nighttime soap. And so as we progress kind of in this podcast, I think I'd like to learn more about some of the shows like Dark Shadows that preceded Twin Peaks and how they may have influenced the production. Dark Shadows, which was this gothic soap opera that was a real departure at the time. And another thing I'm interested in looking at as we proceed and back to the double R is the role of women in Twin Peaks. We have a lot of really interesting female characters, and that's going to be a perspective that I'd like to share throughout. And in terms of the pilot, as I mentioned, I vividly remember the first time I watched Twin Peaks. I was alone in my apartment. I turned off all the lights. I was already a David Lynch fan. I had seen Eraserhead. I'd seen Blue Velvet. And I remember just sitting in my apartment and being blown away, thinking, I have never seen anything like this on television before. You know, this is just insane. It was so outside the mainstream. It was just not, you know, other things on at the time, like Beverly Hills 90210, you know, it was completely different sort of teen, look at teen world, very dark and super haunting. And as I rewatched it, it was interesting to kind of pay attention to, you know, like I mentioned, I'm interested in the female characters. And the first person that we see in the episode is Josie Packard. We watch her herself in a mirror. That's the first person that we see in the episode. And what does that mean for the framing of the episode and the series? You know, what is Josie's role? She's the only Asian American character, I believe, in that first episode. And she's sort of portrayed as an outsider. And I think that's part of it, where she has sort of this outside perspective, but is also viewed as an outsider by some of the characters. And in fact, as things progress, we see almost a catfight like nature of this combative relationship that she has with Catherine. And that also to me seems like sort of a nod to nighttime soaps like Dynasty, that in this pilot, they're kind of introducing not only all sorts of romantic entanglements and intrigue and a murder, but also these battles between women, which is a real stereotype for soap operas in general. There are so many characters introduced in the pilot. It's sort of unbelievable and kind of hard to keep track of. But it, you know, like a true soap opera, you've got all these intertangled stories, and it's, you know, in the first episode, you're never quite sure how all these people are going to be related. We're just starting to see hints of that. So I'm interested in, you know, maybe talking to all of you, my fellow hosts, about, you know, what does it mean for the framing of this episode that we see Josie first?
I'll jump in on that if I may. you know, I think one of the things that Colin is going to talk about a lot over the course of this podcast is sort of what lies beneath, right? And I think that first moment with Josie really speaks to that, in so far as we see her, she's putting on makeup, obviously, so she's sort of, you know, physically changing her appearance, right? And it's this very sort of everyday activity, right? But it's paired with this super ominous music, right? So we know right from the get-go that there's something very wrong, right? There's something very unnerving about this really sort of ordinary activity that she's engaging in. And I think it does a really good job of setting up the atmosphere for the whole show immediately, right? Because we take this very sort of common thing and we make it ominous. And I think for her specifically, you know, it also sets her up to be this, you know, complex character with a lot of secrets, which, you know, secrets, of course, a huge part of the whole show.
I think, you know, the makeup applying and looking in the mirror, you know, we're also being presented her she's being presented as somebody to look at. And Agent Cooper, when he first sees her, he's like, oh, who's the babe? Mm. You know, so she's definitely somebody that we are watching, she's watching herself, we're watching her, other characters are watching her.
Well, I'll jump in with a couple of observations on Josie Packard, played by Joan Chen. One thing that is said later on in the episode, when Cooper, played by Colin McLaughlin, is talking to Sheriff Truman, played by Michael Onkin. You know, Michael Onkin, he says, oh, you know, that's, you know, the most beautiful woman in the Pacific Northwest, or the most beautiful woman in the state. So I definitely think that, like, Lynch and Frost are definitely sort of exoticizing the Asian female character, which might be a bit, you know, problematic in itself. And I think there's certainly an element of, like, watching or observing, or, you know, oh, like, you know, what is this person? And also from a practical level, when the episode was first written, they envisioned Isabella Rossellini, who was sort of, you know, David Lynch's muse, the star of Blue Velvet. So the character was originally conceived as Italian American instead of Chinese American. And it could simply be a function of, he wanted Isabella Rossellini first. And, you know, when they did the episode over again, hey, it's Joan Chen. And it's also something I forgot, because I've seen the show many, many times. I thought for sure Pete is the first character we see walk down to the river and find Laura Palmer wrapped in plastic. But sure enough, Josie is the first human being we see on screen. And I, you know, there's definitely reasons for it. And they want you to keep women in mind while you're watching this show too. I think just as a, you know, way to go about things.
Yeah, they're definitely at the crux of it. You know, Laura Palmer is essentially the star of the episode too. You know, we see her dead body, and then we see her in framed photos. We see her in video. So she's always sort of haunting. She haunts the whole series, really. So those twin storylines are super intriguing to me.
One thing that, you know, I think I'm going to say right out in the front here in terms of like what kind of a rewatcher I am or how I approach like looking at a show, like I'm really like a, you know, nuts and bolts kind of guy. I like digging into the technical aspects, who the actors are, what they played. I'm also someone that generally likes to sort of stick to the text of the show. I'm not usually too patient with like a lot of the outlandish theorizing or speculation, even though I know it's a huge part of the fandom. So that might be a nice balance. If you guys kind of want to like go into that sort of stuff, I might be the more of a, no, I'm like, you know, a reality check, or, oh, does it actually show up in the show somewhere that we can, you know, go from? So that's, you know, definitely going to be, you know, my sort of take on the show here. The other thing I want to really do is sort of, you know, let's kind of maybe start by, you know, taking a deep dive into the character. And I did mention that, you know, one of the things that I kind of misremembered about the show was that the first character, you know, I thought we saw was going to be Pete, when really he's the second, although he is very, very important. For one, he's played by Jack Nance, who is sort of, you know, part of the David Lynch sort of repertoire of actors, if you will. He was the star of Eraserhead, and he is in several like of Lynch's projects. And I think one of the things that Lynch took with him going from film to TV is he wants to bring, you know, some comfort food with them. You know, he's used to Jack Nance. He's used to people like Catherine Coulson, who plays the Log Lady, has showed up in many of his works. The actress, I can't think of her name right now, who plays Major Briggs's wife, was also in Eraserhead. I know Everett McGill, who plays Big Ed, is also sort of part of that sort of repertoire. So he brings Pete with him from, you know, different places. And, you know, one thing I like about the character, is if we're going to put him on like a sort of Dungeons and Dragons character spectrum, he's almost like a true neutral. You know, he's there for people to bounce ideas off of or have momentous events happen, even though he is a bit of an eccentric. And you'll see that, you know, he's got a lot of the humor of the show, like when he puts the fish in the coffee, or, you know, just kind of like how he's, you know, in his office puttering 2x4s and 4x8s. He's definitely representative of sort of the eccentricities of a lot of the characters that you guys are going to see going forward. So what do people feel about Pete Martell? Like, how do we sort of see him as maybe almost like a guide to the episode? Colin?
Yeah, he sort of stands in for the viewer in some ways. I think we have said that he is going to be the person who is the least duplicitous, in a sense. He's the guy who, over the course of the series, I think is going to maybe change the least, or at least if there is a spectrum of people who are, you know, really, you know, deceptive, or, you know, with multiple identities, he's one who's almost exactly who he seems to be. And although we don't know it yet, he's going to kind of stand out in that way.
What else, Damon?
I think he's also in many ways the most likable character on the show. He's someone you could imagine just like getting together with for a cup of coffee, or like having him over to your house for dinner, you know. As much as like everybody loves Agent Cooper, and of course he's a really likable character, Kyle MacLachlan's great and he's so quirky, like he's somebody who would be really frustrating to have as a friend, I think. because he just like can't stay focused on anything. He's always going off on these weird tangents.
Super honest.
You know, throughout the show. Yeah, right. Throughout the show, you definitely feel like, as much as I don't think it's a spoiler to say he and Sheriff Truman become really good friends. And their relationship is a huge part of the show. A lot of times you feel like you can relate to how exasperated Sheriff Truman gets with Cooper. Whereas Pete is just like a down to earth guy. You know, you could imagine standing on a bank and throwing a fishing line into the water with him and just spending a very pleasant afternoon.
Yeah, Damon, I mean, I'm obviously from the Northwest. My grandfather lived in Hansville, Washington for the last, you know, 40 plus years of his life. And even though I think Pete in the show is younger than my grandfather was when I knew him, like I was kind of thinking of Pete as my grandpa. Like he, you know, my grandpa wore like those flannel shirts and went fishing and, you know, kind of was a quirky old man, like puttered about. I think you really, you know, that's sort of your friendly grandpa that you can hug on to and sort of, you know, feel safe in a show that can quite often be very, very dangerous.
Well, and so many people in the first episode, as the pilot kind of progresses, you start to see like all of these secret aspects to so many characters. And with him, it's more what you see is what you get.
What you see is what you get.
But everyone else is sort of like, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion and everybody else where you're like, wait, I thought this person was on the up and up. And it turns out they're not.
I agree. One thing I'm also going to sort of pick on here before we get into our next host is my favorite scene of the pilot was the sort of the 7-minute sequence where, you know, they're at the high school. And Bobby Briggs, played by Dana Ashbrook, comes in and, you know, the sort of the vice principal reprimands him. And then, you know, you see the guy kind of doing the little boogie in the hallway. And then it gets into the classroom and focusing on Laura's like empty chair. And there's like, you know, you see like in that courtyard through the window, the girl screams and, you know, Laura Flynn Boyle as Donna is there. And so is James Hurley, played by James Marshall. And so they all kind of almost know what's going to be said before what is actually said, that, you know, the teacher, you know, makes the announcement that, you know, Laura Palmer is dead. And then, I mean, even better is when that principal gets on, you know, that microphone and just like, you know, he can barely even like get the words out without breaking down that their classmate has died. And then, you know, the sequence ends where they go to like the trophy room and there's the really, really famous picture of, you know, Laura Palmer, which is the face we see at the end of most episode, that picture in the frame. And, you know, the Laura Palmer's theme swells and swells and swells, and then it, you know, cuts right there. And I mean, I think that's just the money scene of that episode that kind of really brings in a lot of, you know, the themes of like how people grieve and what, you know, there might be saying about sort of the supernatural elements going on.
And Laura literally in the trophy case, you know, like that's
for sure.
So like fascinating. I agree. Like, great scene. You know, the whole 50s vibe of it is interesting. And I don't know if I'd kind of seen that before where, you know, it's supposed to be contemporary times, but it feels like it's in the past. You know, people are wearing these sort of 50s skirts and I don't know, the whole vibe of it. And it's very quiet, which like you think of hallways at schools as being loud and bustling, but, you know, you have the mood music, so it has to be sort of quiet.
I don't think he's aiming for verisimilitude,
right,
with a lot of the stuff.
Exactly. Right?
It's sort of like how, you know, Stephen King, I think, is in the same way, because I think Lynch and King are about the same age where, you know, for them, high school is always like 50. So I don't know if that's a reflection of like, you know, Lynch's own sort of childhood experiences with like, you know, growing up, or if like that's his ideal. But yeah, it's for sure, you know, like, I don't, you know, I mean, I wasn't a high school kid at that time, but, you know, even when I was a high school a few years later, like, girls didn't wear skirts. You know what I'm saying? Like, although, you know, like Bobby and the boys are more like I, you know, I knew people that dressed like Bobby Briggs and James Hurley and Mike. Right. But, you know, but the women are for sure, I think, kind of like what we've been touching on, maybe an idealized or a romanticized version of, you know, how Lynch sees grown up. And guys, what do you think?
I mean, there's definitely like a James, you know, more on the 50s, like there's always like a James Dean feel, but I even feel that in things like 90210, which was also on the air around the same time. Like there's some of these tropes that you continue to see in teen television, and in the 50s is when we had the invention of the teenager in America. So it kind of makes sense.
Well, I'll go ahead. So I'm interested in going back to this show because it has so much power in my imagination. And when I started talking to David about rewatching it with him, it was only then that I realized I had only watched through it once back when it first came out. And I could hardly imagine that that was true, because it occupied so much of my adult consciousness and it was so present in popular culture. I saw Fire Walk With Me in the theaters, and I saw all of the first season and some of, but not all of, the second season, and have not yet seen the third season. So, you know, I'm much more of a dilettante than I feel like. I think part of it is because I have listened to the Angelo Badalamenti soundtrack 1,000 times. And so part of what's happening is that when I listen to the soundtrack, I'm replaying images from the series in my mind. And that's my only explanation for why I feel like I've seen it more than I have. Diving back into the pilot was a great experience and reminded me of what I want to, what I'd like to sort of explore here. And we've touched on a lot of these things already, but the idea of surfaces. So there are, you know, Josie's putting on her makeup. She's gazing at herself in a mirror. We're watching her watch herself make herself into something she's not. I mean, there is an announcement that things are going to, you know, it's going to be a house of mirrors. So I'm interested in sort of themes and imagery throughout the series. And I'm interested in the story as a puzzle. We see right away that it's a puzzle. It has soap opera vibes. It has murder mystery vibes. But it has so much cultural power that I think it's worth asking, how does this puzzle really challenge viewers, and how are we supposed to deal with it? Because it was one of the early shows, along with you know, Dallas, Who Shot JR, and some of these other shows, The Fugitive, where the question of the primary mystery got out into the wider culture. Who Killed Laura Palmer is one of those powerful ideas. And so what kind of puzzle is this? You know, what are we watching when we dive into the pilot? Are we watching a soap opera? Are we watching a mystery? Are we watching supernatural horror? I think that's interesting. And then I'm interested in this wider impact of the show itself. I think it's worth thinking about the fact that in television production, you know, everything more or less is intentional. There are no mistakes. What is on the screen is meant to be on the screen, and audiences will, you know, absorb that and they will make their own meaning. So, you know, this is a particular kind of perspective in critical theory. We could draw a whole bunch of different ideas down, the auteur theory, where, you know, everything that Lynch and Frost are doing and other creators of the show has a central meaning and is all on purpose. But then at the same time, audiences are watching and trying to figure out what to do with it, making their own meaning. So over the course of the pilot and the show itself, we see these eruptions from underneath. This is something that happens in Blue Velvet and in other Lynch films as well, this idea that the darkness underneath is breaking through the placid surface. We see it again and again. And that rich 1950s nostalgia, you know, is, as Jennifer was saying, is so acute. It really feels to me like high 80s, which was kind of a recapitulation of the 50s, transitioning into the 90s, which had kind of a darker edge to it, I think. And, you know, that idea of surfaces, reflections, things hidden within other things. We, you know, we see the letter R hidden under Laura Palmer's fingernail that's pulled out by Agent Cooper. We see James's motorcycle reflected in Laura's eye, and only you know, Agent Cooper has the vision to sort of see that. So there's a lot of wonderful stuff to play with in that I'll be looking at over the course of Back to the Double R. And I guess I would ask the crew how does this idea of the darkness erupting into our, you know, picture postcard life in Twin Peaks, how does that strike you?
I mean some of it's subtle in the production. Like, some of the images that are left with me from this episode are things like ceiling fans overhead spinning around, and telephones hanging, and streetlights wavering. Like, all these things are sort of nodding at this unease that there are some other forces at work besides the humans. So this non-human imagery, I think, is something that really sticks out at me.
Well, Jennifer, I have like one thing to say to that specific point. One thing you'll notice about when you watch the pilot is it's filmed like a movie, and Lynch really takes a lot of time to get coverage of like stuff that's like trees blowing in the wind from like the Pacific Northwest, or like they might show like, you know, like scenes in nature, or you know, flowing water or stuff like that. And Lynch wants you to pay attention to that stuff, which on a different TV show might just be filler. The other thing that I did want to say in terms of things like erupting from the surface is emotions. When I rewatched the pilot episode, one thing I was really, really struck by was like how much like there's sort of tension between let's keep everything normal versus like what people want to just like, you know, get out under their systems. Like when they're looking at Laura Palmer's body, Andy, played by Harry Goes, I mean, he's just, you know, he's a mess. He's crying, he's sobbing, and like Truman's like, hey, Andy, you know, get it together, right? And like the, you know, Troy Evans, who plays the principal in the high school, again, like he can barely like get through his announcement before he, you know, sort of breaks down. And I mean, Josie even, right, like has another moment in the pilot where, you know, Catherine's like, hey, we're keeping the mill open. But the, you know, Ronette's father like works at the mill, and she's like, no, you know, I'm giving these men like time to, you know, to, you know, to grieve or spend with their families. And, you know, Catherine is like, that's not in the interest of capitalism or making money. So there's all that sort of stuff going on, you know, within the episode, like suppressing emotion versus bursts of emotion.
Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. And I think that's the soap opera genre that Lynch sort of uses as a model, but then he ratchets things up far, much farther than we would normally see. And the, you know, the avatar for that in my mind is Grace Zabriskie in that opening sequence, and another, you know, beloved Lynch collaborator, longtime collaborator, an amazing actor. And he just lets her cut loose. And what she does is, for me, it's like the buzzsaws that we see, you know, tearing apart the lumber, like the way she screams and emotes when she puts two and two together, it makes your spine tingle. And that's part of why this show was different than just any other show, I think, that Lynch was not only willing, but masterful at turning things up at certain moments, taking a familiar formula, and then at the right moment, intensifying something so much, like the horror or the nostalgia or this emotional eruption, that, you know, we couldn't look away. And we all, you know, so many of us remember the first time we watched it because it was just fascinating.
Thank you so much for for bringing up that moment, because I've been looking for the right the right place to talk about that. As many times as I've seen that pilot now, that moment where Grace Zabriskie breaks down, that is still the moment that I find hard to watch, because the intensity of the emotion right there is just, I mean, it's, you feel it with her, you know? But the other thing that I wanted to point out there is that nobody in this episode needs to be told that it's Laura Palmer that has died, right? Except Bobby, I guess, right? Everybody else, you know, they put it together, right? Because a sheriff walks in or whatever, right? Her dad doesn't need to be told. She doesn't need to be told. And so, you know, what's interesting about that is that it makes it very clear without having to say it. And this is something that's elaborated on in later episodes and in the Laura Palmer diary, right? Is that basically she had been sort of crying out for help for a long time in various ways. And it was ignored, right? It was swept under the surface, right? To keep the sort of like veneer of the like happy town and the perfect family, or, I mean, different people, I'm sure, as we'll see, had different reasons for sweeping things under the surface. But, you know, as someone will say in a later episode, people knew she was in trouble, right? And so we go from this sort of perfect image of her as this like image of, you know, the perfect prom queen, you know, innocent girl or whatever. And as we'll see over the course of the series, we learn more about her life, and there's a lot more going on than that, right? And what's interesting is that as much as things are secret, that doesn't actually seem to have been much of a secret to most people.
Now that's, yeah, I think you're right on there too. And I also want to touch on like contemporary criticism, like kind of didn't really go for Grace Zabriskie as Sarah Palmer. They thought it was like, you know, way over the top, like, you know, this is bad acting almost. But now when I rewatch the show, and especially in context of the show entire, like, first of all, Sarah Palmer is an extremely important character. And, you know, second of all, Grace Zabriskie is amazing. She is like hands down one of the acting pros of the show. And like every time she's on screen, it's very enjoyable. And, you know, she has a very difficult role that I think, you know, is done unforgettably. So, you know, it's interesting to look back, you know, 30 years ago, people thought this was crazy. But now when you rewatch it, it's really almost sort of part of the, you know, the glue of the show itself. It doesn't work without that performance.
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in talking about over the course of our podcast is the way the sort of specifically Lynchian way of storytelling gets us to different ideas. I'm a huge David Lynch fan. I've seen all of his work that's reasonably easy to access, most of it multiple times. And I found it hard for a long time to articulate sort of what made it so resonant for me. And what I finally figured out was that Lynch's work feels like my dreams. And I'm sure lots of other people have had that same sensation, right? Which I guess tells you something about the weird, dark places my head goes sometimes. But Lynch has a way of telling stories that's really different from anybody else in mainstream American film, I think. And it is a way that is really dreamlike. And it's a way that really, I think, invites the audience to think about different ideas and to revisit the films to continue to explore those ideas from different angles, right? So like Colin said, it really is a puzzle. But in a way, like most of Lynch's work, you know, it's a puzzle that you can put together in different ways and get different pictures, right? And so that's what's really intriguing about it to me, is that there are lots of different stories, some of which are more fruitful than others, that, you know, encourage us to explore different ideas, to think about, you know, does Twin Peaks have a central theme, or are there several central themes? What are those themes, and how do these sort of specifically Lynchian details get us to think about these ideas? So for that reason, I think I'm particularly interested in the sort of supernatural elements of the show, because they are so distinctively Lynchian and sort of you know, unexplainable in a lot of ways. But a lot of that also comes from just the editing, you know, what we were talking about earlier with this focus on sort of mundane objects and giving them sort of a weight that suggests underlying ideas, but without ever sort of telling us, this is what you should think about that, right? So when it comes to the pilot, the thing that I really want to focus on today is this idea of the world of Twin Peaks that is created by the pilot. And so we've already kind of talked a little bit about the sort of temporal world that's created by sort of mashing up the 50s and the 80s and the early 90s. And I think there's like a hint of early 60s in there too. You know, of course we see James, who's the sort of quintessential 50s biker, but Bobby looks like he just came out of a Tad show at the Crocodile Cafe in Seattle. Audrey looks like the girl gone wrong from the cover of like a pulp novel, but you know, Donna's got these oversized 80s sweaters. And then of course the double R, our namesake, is the sort of location equivalent of that, I think, right? It looks like a 50s diner, but there's this weird dark music on the jukebox that's, you know, maybe not quite at home in any era, but certainly feels a lot more contemporary. And so what all of this does for me is creates a vision of a town that is, if not untouched by time, it's sort of resistant to some of the time, the changes that time brings. And the sort of darkly tinged nostalgia that comes with that is really in keeping with a lot of David Lynch's other projects. And a big part of that is the locations, right? The locations are so key to creating this world. And they work so well that even though we move to a soundstage after this pilot episode, the establishing shots that were created for this pilot are so distinct that they allow us to keep sort of the distinct feeling of this town and this world, even as the production values shift in some pretty dramatic ways. And it keeps us in the feeling of this distinctively Pacific Northwest world. Although I should point out here that the actual sort of geography of the town is a little bit puzzling, because it's supposed to be located near Spokane, which for people who aren't from Washington State is on the eastern side of the state and a lot more like Idaho than like the West Coast in a lot of ways. But the locations themselves are all pulled from Western Washington, right? We have Paul's Bow, where John and I grew up, North Bend, Seattle, and all of these other places. And I think Lynch invites us to really think about these locations by giving the characters so much dialogue about the place that the events are unfolding. It's, you know, we see Cooper sitting in the car with Truman, whittling his whistle and talking about what kind of a town this is, right? And in that way, I think the town is almost a character in the show on its own.
I think that's really on point. There's something that Lynch is doing here when he both gives us specific locations, but also suffuses the whole thing with sort of a fairy tale effect, you know, the beautiful shot of what we know as Snoqualmie Falls has a real fairy tale to it. And it's going to become a dark fairy tale, but the town of Twin Peaks exists sort of separate from concrete time and space. And this may be part of why it lasts. I think that's a great observation. It kind of has a Brigadoon quality to it. Like you can drive into it, but other people might drive right through it and never even see it. And so it becomes magical
And Colin, the fairy tale that you mentioned, you know, the first thing we see in the opening credits is the bird. And so then that has sort of, right. I don't know, to me, kind of a Disney quality to it, you know.
Sure.
And then how perfect that you have maybe a sweet fairy tale Disney exterior and then, oh, some really bad stuff's about to happen.
That's right.
Well, and which happens in Disney too. Network.
And that introduction is so amazing because it immediately goes from the bird to the shot of the factory to the shot of the buzzsaws being sharpened and those sparks shooting off these blades. And then it just lingers on those blades being sharpened, right? And we just know that things are going to get torn to shreds.
Which, I mean, and again, with the Disney, you know, there is darkness beneath the surface in Disney, in the Disney classics, you know, based on, you know, fairy tales and stories. So all of that is so apt.
Yeah. And Laura looks like a princess. Even
she has a crown,
you know, she has. Yeah, that's right. And she has little sparkles. The detritus on her face is sparkling and it's corruption, but it's kind of beauty too. She's sort of a sleeping beauty there.
Well, and I think it taps into something really, really primal in that way, right? Where as long as people, I think, have been telling stories, there have been stories about something scary in the woods that is menacing to the townspeople, right? And so in that way, it really, the Pacific Northwest setting allows Lynch to tap into something that's, I mean, it's not just cultural. I think it's primal. I think it's, you know, maybe it's genetic memory even.
No, Damon, I think you're 100% right there. A couple of little observations I had, going back to the high school, right, which is Cy High School in Snohomish, Washington. One thing that really struck me was when you look at the wall, it has that red striping, which goes up and then down, almost sort of like, you know, like a heartbeat on a monitor, right? Like you see the little waves going up and down and then it like flatlines, which has to be 100% intentional, man. And then even like there's weird sort of incongruities in the details. Like if you look at the roadhouse, because like I think the first shot, they show like a little sign with like bikes parked in front of it. And then they show it like as sort of almost like a huge like barn-like structure. And then like the inside of the bar just doesn't seem to match out there, which is, I mean, a typical sort of like fairy tale location, right? It could house anything. And I also think that the sign we see when we're, you know, in the credits going into Twin Peaks, where it says the population of the town is like 51,000 something, you know, a town like that big would make it one of the biggest cities in Washington, which, you know, if you look at Twin Peaks, you're like, no way this like, is this town that big? And, you know, I guess ABC was saying, well, you know, nobody will believe that, you know, this is a town of like 5,000 people. So they, you know, had them like add, you know, whatever number it is to make it to 51,000. But I think it speaks to like the theme of like, well, there's, you know, there's a little town with lots of stuff going on, you know, underneath the surface, right? It's, you know, everything is, it might be small or, you know, not so big on the outside, but when you get involved, there's infinite potential.
So I guess a quick question for you all before we bring this into the conclusion, unlike a lot of shows from the time, for all the reasons we've discussed, the setting is actually really important, right? A lot of shows from this time really could have been set anywhere and the narrative would work just as well, right? In Twin Peaks, the setting is obviously so important. Can we imagine this show set somewhere else?
I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking about other Lynch films that are set in the suburbs. I mean, I guess it could have been in a small town. I'm not from the Pacific Northwest. I'm from Northern California suburbs. So I don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine Twin Peaks not being where it is, because as we've just been talking about for nearly an hour, there's so much of this sort of Northwest woodsy element to it. I suppose it could be in Maine. You know, we've mentioned Stephen King a little bit. I suppose it could have been in a little corner in Maine. You know, Stephen King sets all of his stories in Maine, and I can imagine all that creepiness happening in a small town in Maine too, or on an island.
There's something about the border that's going to emerge too, right? In the same sense that there's a dark undercurrent and a surface, there's a lot of talk about the border. And, you know, I do remember we'll, you know, hear about that later, like crossing over the border and stepping back and forth. And, you know, it's supposed to be up close toward the Canadian, in some accounts, it's close to the Canadian border. So it has a mythic structure to it that could be a lot of places. I think about the Southwest and something like Red Rock West with Lara Flynn Boyle. So, you know, there are towns that function in different ways, but Lynch was really canny in using the richness of the Northwest because of that point you were making earlier. It is right next to the Big Bad Woods.
I guess my two cents is, on a practical level, one, yes, I can definitely imagine Twin Peaks being in other locations because I've seen season 3 and the less said, the better, right? I also think that, you know, when you look at like the Pacific Northwest and maybe why people decide to move to the Pacific Northwest or like what kinds of things happen. I mean, and this is especially true of the late 80s when it was set. I mean, like Ted Bundy was from the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, it's always been kind of a home to like people who want to, you know, get away from mainstream society or, you know, this, it's no coincidence that you've got like Ted Bundy and the Green River Killer, like coming from this part of the nation. And I mean, it's gloomy 6 months out of the year. You know, when people, you know, move to Washington for the first time and they're like, well, what's winter like? I'm like, well, you know, it's not as like, you know, rainy as you know, think it, but it's gray for 6 months solid. And if you've never had to deal with like 6 months of gray, you know, you're going to feel kind of weird after that, right? You're going to be like, oh my God, there's the sun. And I definitely think Lynch captures that sort of specific vibe of the Pacific Northwest and applies it to sort of like the, hey, there's the dark monster in the woods sort of a thing. Like he's grooming us as we watch the show to be ready to, you know, meet that darkness on its own terms. You know, he's, you know, the show kind of handholds you from the pilot all the way through the 40th episode in season 3 to, you know, get ready to see things that you're not going to believe or find things that may not want to be found, right? Like, you know, it's people come to the Northwest to get away from, you know, sort of the mainstream of society. And what better location to have a show where you're going to find nothing but mystery upon mystery upon mystery.
It's interesting that you have to be prepared for that. When I was a kid, my dad's job got transferred to Oregon, and we went up and looked at houses, looked at schools, and the weather ultimately for us sunny California suburb family, it was too gloomy. So that's an interesting perspective about the weather and the vibe of the Pacific Northwest. And what does that mean? What are the associations that we have with that? And why is that important to the show?
Well, this seems like a good place to pivot to our closing question.
So we're going to try and wrap up each episode of Back to the Double R with a twist, something that is a little unexpected, something that is a little different, something that people maybe haven't prepared for. But this is sort of our broad first episode. And so I would put to my distinguished colleagues here, why is this show still important to you after all this time?
So I think there are two reasons for me. One is very personal. I watched Twin Peaks for the first time, the show that is, not my sort of spooky basement experience with Fire Walk With Me in college. I watched the show for the first time during an uncharacteristically cold winter in Seattle, Washington. The weather people warned of this horrible snow that was going to come in, and we were all going to be stuck in the house for days, which did in fact turn out to be true. I lived on a hill and, you know, watched cars fail to get up that hill in the ice because Seattle owns no snow plows. And my roommates and I had all been meaning to check out Twin Peaks because we were all fans of David Lynch's other work. And we went to Scarecrow Video and we rented the box set, and we spent the next 3 days, you know, drinking the last of the eggnog because, you know, Christmas had just passed, and just diving into Twin Peaks. And every night, shortly before bed, a couple of us would go walk around in the snow and just talk about it and talk about, you know, what we thought was going on and what was coming next. Right. You know, I miss the Pacific Northwest a lot. I grew up there. I lived there, you know, most of my life. And so for me, part of it is just, you know, sort of an opportunity to sort of revisit that feeling and that time. Right. So there's that sort of personal level. Right. The other thing is, though, as I alluded to earlier, there's something about Lynch's work that speaks to me on a really deep level, and I think sort of helps me make sense of my own mind a little bit better. And Twin Peaks is probably the most fun way to do that because, I mean, let's face it, you know, you got to be in just the right mood to sit down with Lost Highway or Inland Empire. That stuff is really dark, and Twin Peaks is too, but it's got a lot of humor and, you know, is lively and enjoyable. And I think for that reason that you've got sort of the tension between the darkness and the humor, I think lends itself more to sort of regular repetition than a lot of Lynch's other works. Plus there's just a lot more of it, right? So it's harder to get tired of it.
I totally get that. There is more eye candy. Like sitting down to watch Blue Velvet, you're going to be, you know, you got to kind of gird yourself for a really intense time. But like many teen shows, Twin Peaks also has like, ooh, like I could just watch it for the fashion, you know, just with a fashion yes. perspective. And that would be super fun. And the music, I love the music in it. So mm-hmm. the whole vibe of it is a fulfilling watch. You know, I've also been a David Lynch fan for a really long time, and things like Eraserhead are also not necessarily easy viewing. So Twin Peaks is a departure in that respect, in that it's something that, you know, is more of a mass market consumption sort of thing. And there's so many different layers to it, which is why I was intrigued by this whole rewatch project too, just to look at the series with fresh eyes and see all these different layers, and then also see what has transpired in the decades since it first came out, and what is the influence of Twin Peaks on some of the other media that I watch today. And it's also an opportunity really to discover some of the influences on Twin Peaks that I might not have known about before.
So, like, I'll answer the question, why is Twin Peaks still important to me after all this time? Well, for one, I agree that it's the gateway drug for David Lynch, right? So there's that. But I guess I'll answer it in two parts as well. For one, why is it important to me? And I'll just say representation matters. Now, we're going to touch on, you know, minority representation. I'm Mexican-American. But in terms of representation for me, you know, I've seen dozens of shows that are set in, like, Washington or Seattle, and there's never been one where I look at a show from where I'm from, where I'm like, that's what it's like where I'm from. And Twin Peaks is the only show I've ever seen that nails it. There was a show that AMC did a few years ago called The Killing that is, I think, very much like trying to do like what Twin Peaks does, that I think was very unsuccessful. And just because you could tell that people had never been to Seattle or never, like, you know, done anything from the Northwest, they just, you know, pitch stuff out, or it's a show filmed in Vancouver, or you look at like Grey's Anatomy, I'm like, I had never seen no Grey's Anatomy and no Seattle, nowhere ever, and I've lived here for almost 20 years. So for me, Twin Peaks is an important show because it's home. You know, like I know what them woods look like, because guess what, I lived, you know, right outside of them in Kingston, Washington, in Kitsap County, with big ass Douglas fir trees, you know, like all those locations to me feel very, very homey. And I guess the other reason is, I think earlier when we talked, I compared Twin Peaks to the Pixies' Doolittle album in the sense that, you know, it comes out right at the end of a decade, and it's sort of both, I think, is in the spirit of the decade it came out, and it also, like, predicts the future of what things are going to be in the same way that, like, you know, Doolittle very much predicted grunge music instead of how, like, the 90s would sound. Twin Peaks is the blueprint for TV, I think, going forward. And you see it in shows like Lost, right, which is another sort of puzzle box mystery. Or you even see it in a show like Mad Men, which is all about, like, mood and, you know, like, sort of period era details, but also, like, the sort of the deep connection of the characters and, you know, being okay with things going slow, or, you know, spending time on issues that make you uncomfortable. Like, there's so many shows and movies that are just, you know, grandchildren of what Lynch and Mark Frost, you know, started over 30 years ago. And it's evergreen, you know, it's just like the trees that are around here. Like, you know, I look at it and it's still fresh. It doesn't feel like a show that's 30 years old to me. It feels like a show that could have come out yesterday. And sometimes I, you know, wonder how society would react if, like, the show came out now with, like, no context behind it. You know, because you look at the ratings and NCIS is, like, the most watched show on TV. And that's just crap that, like, people watch because they want to turn off their brains and, like, you know, feel good and see the hero solve the mystery at the end of the episode. And I mean, I haven't said this yet, but I'll say this, that if you're, you know, watching Twin Peaks for the first time or rewatching it and expecting there to be answers or like solve mysteries, you're watching it wrong, man. Just, you know, put yourself in the mind frame of just letting things happen and experience the show that way. You're going to feel much better about it. And I guess that's why I still love it.
Well, you know, so much of what you folks have said is true for me too. And I was eager to dive back into this in part because of the third season, which is kind of a fascinating phenomenon, right? Getting to go back to a show that, you know, 30 years later, it happened with the X-Files, and I guess also Saved by the Bell. Maybe, you know, this is a new trend, but going back to Twin Peaks is a little different. The stakes are higher.
Even 90210, Colin.
That's right. But going back to Twin Peaks, because of the show that it was, because of the place that it was in our imagination, is different. There are still monsters there. The stakes are higher, and you don't know when you pull into town how you are going to be changed by that experience, by spending time there. And, you know, that's just irresistible. So I think we're going to have a lot of fun on this podcast.
Well, that seems like a great place to leave things. Thanks everyone for joining us for this this first discussion. Thank you to Pittsburgh's own Silencio for the music. And we'll see you next week at Back to the Double R.
Bye.
Bye.